You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now bring you Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism, with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome once again to Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. We are still, of course, very much in the Christmas season, and I hope that over the last week or 10 days or so, many of our thoughts have turned, not infrequently, to the place where Jesus was born, to the time of his birth, to the creche, to the very holy cave in Bethlehem, where heaven met earth, where for the one and only time in the history of creation, God became man and was born of the Virgin Mary most miraculously in the cave of Bethlehem. And so I thought this would be a great opportunity today. I happen to have the pleasure of being friends with another enthusiastic Jewish entrant into the Catholic Church, convert, so to speak, who actually has been rather intimately involved with Bethlehem in a number of ways and has had the great privilege of praying actually in the birth cave during over Christmas in Bethlehem itself, and also who's very familiar with the situation, both the prayer situation in Bethlehem and some of the more temporal kind of conflict-ridden situations there. So I thought it would be very nice for us to turn our thoughts back about 8 days to Bethlehem and kind of vicariously try to experience Christmas in Bethlehem. So with that introduction, let me introduce, you may remember her from being on the show earlier in the course of the show when the title was still Salvation is from the Jews. She was on to give her witness testimony, and today I invited her back on to talk about a Christmas in Bethlehem. Are you there, Claire?
Yes, I am. Hi, Roy.
Great. Hi.
Thank you for having me on.
This. Well, you know, I've always been a bit envious. I've had the privilege of praying in the birth cave, which was a mind-blowing experience, but not over Christmas. And I know that you have. So I guess maybe you can start anywhere you want to start, but you might maybe start with explaining how you came to be in Bethlehem over Christmas.
Okay. Well, the first time I went to Bethlehem over Christmas, I had an idea in my head after listening to the song A Little Town of Bethlehem that wouldn't it be great to actually experience Bethlehem in, at Christmas time. So I went, and it was several years ago. It was actually, I think, the first Christmas that the security in Bethlehem was no longer being done by the Israelis, but actually had been handed over to the Palestinians. And I went to Bethlehem for the Midnight Mass, which is the one broadcast on the TV for the world to see, and experienced the sort of very public side of Bethlehem at Christmas, but didn't stay there. And subsequently, when I went back, I was staying in Jerusalem. Subsequently, when I went back as a guest of the Carmelite Monastery in Bethlehem. So I was able to then experience Christmas in Bethlehem as the less public side of it, the more private, prayerful, and the side of it that the really devout Christians experience. So I've had both the what they call the tourist experience of Bethlehem at Christmas as well as a much more private side of the experience.
Were you able to be in the private experience? Were you able to be in the birth cave over the night of Christmas?
Right. So what happens in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve is there's quite a large celebration during the day with bands and parades and such as the Latin Patriarch comes into town, and there's a beautiful then Vesper service, all in Latin, in the church. And he then goes through and blesses the kids underneath. And then people go home, have Christmas dinner with their families. And then the people who get tickets for the Midnight Mass go to Midnight Mass. But it's a ticketed event. And so it's attended by people from all over the world, but not very many people who actually live in Bethlehem. And then after the Midnight Mass, the patriarch goes down and he puts the model, the statue of the baby Jesus, actually places him in the manger, which is underneath the church. And then at 2:00 in the morning, the basilica is opened, the church is opened for anybody who wants to come and pray in the manger. And what happens then is from 2:00 in the morning until 5:00 in the morning, and this is, you know, the night between, it's Christmas morning, from 2 in the morning until 5 in the morning, there are continuous, one after another, very small masses, very beautiful masses, at the actual birth site of Jesus' crib, which is in a cave underneath the main church. And these masses go on, and they're in all different languages. And typically the last one at 5 in the morning is in English. And so there are folks, and I've done this multiple years, of just staying down there for that whole time from 2 in the morning until 5:30 when the last mass is over, and then walking home back to the Carmel at sunrise on Christmas morning after having spent the night in the manger.
Wow. Wow, you know you're very privileged.
Yes, I know I'm very privileged. And, you know, God gives us all different opportunities. To some, he gives the opportunity of family and large families, and people spend Christmas with their families. And to others of us, he gives the opportunity to have prayer pilgrimages like this. And I've met other people now who go to the Carmel at Christmas, and one of them has become a friend of mine from Belgium, and there's a man who's he's a hermit elsewhere in Israel at another monastery, and he'll spend the night. So, you know, so we're not alone in this, but in prayer, it's a very individual prayer experience. But I also always bring everybody with me in my heart in prayer, and feel that it's a wonderful opportunity to pray and intercede for the whole world.
Amen. So, can you give a little physical description? I mean, how large is the cave? How many people would fit in there? What's it look like?
So it's a series of caves. So, you know, where people lived in the Holy Land, in the desert, in the Judean hillside, right, wilderness, it was hot in the summer, cold in the winter, so people lived in caves, and obviously their animals also were sheltered in these caves. So, and what's happened in the Holy Land is, on all of the sites where different Christian occurrences happen, they built churches over these sites. So the church would be on the main floor. You'd walk into the church, and typically the churches in the Holy Land will have, a portion of them will be for the Latin Rite Catholics, and then a portion for the Greek Orthodox or the Russian Orthodox, and maybe the Armenians. So there'll be different chapels, different side chapels. And that's what's on the first floor of the Church of the Nativity. And then you can walk down into the crypt underneath. You walk down, and you can walk directly down into the room where there's a star on the floor, and that's the site where Jesus was born. And just across from that is the area where the crib was placed in the manger. And you walk down a few more steps into where the crib is, and that area probably holds 10 people at most. And certainly then when the masses are being celebrated, the only people who would be down those steps would be the people, the priest, and who's ever assisting him with celebration of the mass, and then the people who would be attending the mass would be right around it. It's all quite small. How big is it? I don't know. Maybe not very good with sizes, maybe 8 by 10 feet or something. And then there's an area then that extends back from that cave, so to speak, from that grotto, where you can then, and this door is typically always closed. I've never seen the door open except on Christmas night, on Christmas Eve night. You can open a door. There's a door that opens from that cave, and then you go down a little another sort of walkway, and you enter the cave where St. Jerome, where he lived when he translated the Bible, and then also there's a cave down there and the crypt where the relics from the Holy Innocents who were massacred after Jesus' birth, there's a little chapel room and the relics of that. So you can walk through this whole series of caves on Christmas Eve and spend time in prayer in each of these places. And now these are places where typically during the day, you know, when the political situation is good, you might wait an hour and a half online to get into this manger area, and you'd be surrounded by people. You'd be hurried along. You'd have just a brief minute or two to pray. But on Christmas Eve, of course, the numbers of people there are few, and maybe when it's busiest, maybe there might be 75 people down there or something. But there aren't typically tours or anything. And one can find oneself just sort of walking through the whole thing and being alone with a lot of time to pray.
I will just interject. I did, as I said, I've been to the birth cave, not over Christmas, but I remember being a little bit sneaky and that there's a little ledge. There's a shelf where the crib was, a little stone shelf, and that shelf extends a little bit beyond the crib into a little, like, alcove or this little 2-foot by 3-foot kind of hollow in the wall. And I remember once, crouching in that little hollow for about, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes or an hour while people streamed through and being able to kind of camp out there praying and kind of being ignored by these tourist groups coming and going.
Yes, that's typically how I spend the few days after Christmas, especially because one of my friends knows the guards, so we don't have to wait on the line. We can go in the exit. And then we can go in the exit, just park ourselves right there, you know, really pray for all of these people. And, you know, you can tell from the languages that they've come from all over the world. And they'll probably, this is their one moment to be there and pray. And to really pray for them that the Holy Spirit touches them deeply and that the baby Jesus touches them deeply. Because also, you know, they're not just Catholics who are going there. There are all different Christians who are going there, and there are also people, there are Muslims who come also. So it's a wonderful opportunity to pray for conversion to the fullness of the faith, to just sit on that little ledge and pray.
Yeah, well, I have competition, I guess, for that ledge now. That's what you do when you invite Jews into the church, right? I think Jesus said they like the front seats in the synagogues.
Well, but, you know, and in a way it's the front seat, but it's not exactly the front seat, you know, because it is, you know, the other people are actually coming and reverencing. So it's really more we like the good deal, right? Like, this is the good deal.
Well, let me ask you a little bit of an unfair question, but... do you find the experience of prayer itself, the kind of conscious state of consciousness that you're in, is affected by being in these special places like the birth cave?
Well, you know, the line that goes through my head, and I don't want people to run out and start reading T.S. Eliot as a result of this, and I know that this line has been used, so I hope this isn't dissatisfying to use this line. But T.S. Eliot has a line in one of his poems about being at the still point of the turning world. And I'm always very conscious of that, especially because of how tumultuous day-to-day life is in Bethlehem and Jerusalem. That to come, you know, to go through that, to be immersed in that life for a few days, and then to come down into the manger and to be there on Christmas when the whole world's focus is on the place at which one is literally sitting, it does focus one's prayer in a very, very specific and very intense, very deep way. Yes.
So what's the background of Bethlehem? Why did Jesus have to be born in Bethlehem? What's special about Bethlehem?
Okay, now you fill in the blanks if my salvation history is not great. But, you know, and it's in some of our Christmas carols and stuff. What?
As long as I've interrupted my guest for one moment, which is, if this is stirring a thirst in you to be praying in these holy places in the Holy Land, I will be leading a pilgrimage, a Jewish Catholic pilgrimage to the Holy Land, to Israel, in April of 2016, sponsored by the Franciscans of the Holy Land, who are the custodians of most of the holy sites, not of the Basilica in Bethlehem, by the way, but of most of the others. And so we should have good access to these holy sites to pray. And I'll also be incorporating some Jewish theological history, Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, along with that Catholic pilgrimage. So if you want more information about that, just get in touch with me through my website, salvationisfromthejews.com, which unfortunately is down at the moment, but I hope to have it up within a day or two again. Anyway, okay, so what's special about Bethlehem?
Okay, so Bethlehem is, amongst other things, I mean, it plays into the story of Jacob, and, you know, Rachel's tomb is there, but it also, it is the city of David. And I'd heard that phrase before. It's in the scriptures that we read on Christmas. It's, right, the reason that Joseph and Mary had to go to Bethlehem is because Joseph, because of the census and all of that. But I never really connected it until I went to the Carmel, and the Carmelite monastery in the Holy Land, in Bethlehem, and there's one in Nazareth and one in Jerusalem. They were founded by a woman who actually was just raised to the altar of sainthood this year in Rome. And she had a lot of mystical experiences, and she picked the land in Bethlehem. That was the first Carmel in the Holy Land. She picked the land that was specifically the land on which Jesse lived. It was his land in Bethlehem.
Jesse being the father of David.
David's father. So it's the land on which David shepherded the sheep. It's the land on which when Saul went to anoint, David was anointed king to come after Saul, this happened actually in a real place in Bethlehem. So when we think of, you know, the shepherds who were watching by night and the angels came and said, you know, go to the manger, the Messiah has been born. Well, these shepherds were shepherding sheep on the same land that David was shepherding sheep, you know, centuries earlier. So the continuity, you know, it, for me as a having Jewish blood, for me going there and being able both to honor being a part of the tribe of the Jews as well as now in the church of the Savior, it's very moving when these incidents take place, these historic incidents take place in the same geographical spots.
So let me interject two things there. One is, one of the beautiful things about going on pilgrimage to the Holy Land is that all of these theological events in the Bible were real events in real places and took place, you know, on real hillsides, on real lakes, in real physical places, in real caves. And those places still exist. And it is a, if I may use the term, incarnational experience in some sense to be in the place and take that theological truth and have it anchored in this dirt and soil and rock or water or wherever you are. It's, you know, it is a kind of incarnational experience. The other thing that I wanted to kind of just backfill from what you were saying is that within Judaism, you could almost say that the definition of the Messiah to come was the Son of David. You see that in the New Testament, right? People call after Jesus, Son of David, heal me, or, you know, Son of David, do this. And it was always understood, the prophecies already in the Torah, in the very beginning of the Old Testament, that the Messiah to come would be the offspring of Jesse and the offspring of David. So the fact that he was born in David's hometown, he was born on the property of Jesse, is, again, just really, really, really anchors salvation history, you know, on Pentecost Sunday, but anchors salvation history in the Old Testament, and in this case, in Jesse and David and the beginning of the Jewish people. David was, of course, not exactly the first Jewish king, but close to the first Jewish king.
I just want to correct you a little bit, because I'm not sure that Jesse's property extended all of the way to the Church of the Nativity. It's sort of on the hill overlooking it, but I'm not sure that actually where the Carmel is, I know is the property, but I'm not sure it extends all the way. Bethlehem is a series of hills.
I was making that up on just imagining that given the sparsity of the population in those days, properties were very large, but a point well taken.
And that may well be true. I don't actually know, but it certainly, you know, it's not unimaginable when you see how close they are. You know, certainly when I go from Carmel to the Church of the Nativity, it's a short walk. You know, it's a 15-minute walk. So, you know, to think that David and his sheep might not have, of course, walked that far would be, you know, of course they were walking much greater distances than that in the biblical times. You know, that's one of the things that about, this is completely an aside, but going to the Holy Land and really realizing how much all of these people, Jesus and his disciples, the apostles, the Blessed Mother and Joseph, how much they walked, you know, when we get in a bus from one place to the other to the other.
Yes, but when I went to Israel the first time in 1969, a friend of mine, just to get a feeling for the scale of the Holy Land, in his case the Jewish Holy Land, walked from Haifa to Jerusalem, and it was only a two-day walk.
Wow.
It's only maybe 40 or 50 miles, 60 miles. So, in fact, there are long distances to walk by our today's standards, but most of that Old Testament history, at least the one that takes place in Israel, in this, you know, northern and southern kingdoms of Israel, probably take place within a 150-mile radius.
Right. Yeah, sure. And then the southern, which is, you know, I mean, Bethlehem is only, I think it's 6 miles from Jerusalem. So there are people, you know, there's a religious order I know in the Old City, and they walk on Christmas Eve, they walk with a whole group of people from Jerusalem into Bethlehem, and they walk and go out to Mass, not in the Church of the Nativity, but there are also Masses going on one after another after another. Out there's a chapel up of one of the custodians, you know, the Franciscan of the Holy Land, have a chapel up in Shepherd Field, so which is a little area outside of Bethlehem where they say the shepherds were watching their sheep when they, you know, were visited by the angels. So
yes,
there are also Masses all evening on Christmas Eve out at Shepherd's Field to go out to. So, you know, the whole town turns into a celebration of Christmas.
Beautiful. Well, we usually take a short break about halfway through the program, which is about now. So in a moment or two, we will take a short musical break and then come back. And when we come back from the musical break, we'll continue the conversation with Claire and maybe turn to a more temporal view of what Bethlehem is like these days and the compromises, perhaps, to the spirituality which have come about through the political and social tensions there. Or maybe we'll just stay theological. We'll see. But in any case, we'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. This is Roy Shoman. Be back in a moment.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, with Roy Shoman.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism. And I have with me today a guest, Claire, to talk about Bethlehem, a place she knows very well. Let me backpedal a little bit and get a little bit mysterious about, because we were talking just before the break about why Jesus had to be born in Bethlehem, which was the territory of the city of David, and land which, at least some of which, belonged to David's father, Jesse. And we know that prophecies in the Old Testament say that the Messiah will be the root of Jesse, shall come from the stem of Jesse, and will be a descendant of King David. But there is another a kind of etymological curiosity about the word Bethlehem itself. Let me start by saying the Jewish blessing over food, which is said every time any Jew anywhere in the world sits down to eat. He or she says, Baruch et Adonai Eloheinu melech olam hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, which means, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who brings forth bread from the earth. Notice, hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, lechem, which is the second half of the name Bethlehem, because the name Bethlehem in Hebrew means house of bread. Now, we know that the bread come down from heaven, that's our true eternal spiritual nourishment, is of course Jesus in the Eucharist, and the that brings forth bread from the earth, and it was in Bethlehem. Bear with me, I don't know if this is going to hang together, but it was in Bethlehem that God brought forth the divinity of Jesus, brought forth our the Eucharist, so to speak, from the earth, because Jesus in the incarnation, in some sense, was brought forth from Adam. And what does the word Adam mean in Hebrew? The Hebrew word for earth is Adamah. So in bringing forth Jesus from man, so to speak, in bringing forth the incarnation out of mankind, he was, in a sense, bringing forth bread from the earth, and, as I said, Bethlehem being the house of bread. So I don't know if that made sense. It made sense to me, but who knows? Anyway, Claire, jump in there or talk about I don't know how to put it, the temporal side of Christmas in Bethlehem these days, or the difficulties imposed on praying there, or frankly, whatever you like.
Okay, so some of the difficulties, and you know, some of these I experienced most in the most real way the first time I went, and that I went down into Manger Square on Christmas Eve early on, which. You know, it's a very commercialized. Bethlehem is not at all free from the commercialization of Christmas. The square is filled with people selling things and people singing, and a lot of singing of the song, I believe, "Go Tell It on the Mountain." You know, I was expecting to hear, you know, more like "Silent Night" or "A Little Town of Bethlehem." But the singing was much more in the more sort of what I think of as evangelical or Baptist singing on Christmas Eve, and young people hanging out. Obviously, this was a very social occasion for people of all religions, and the Mass, the midnight Mass of Christmas Eve that's celebrated by the Patriarch and televised around the world, it's always been, the person who's always been invited to it has been whoever is the political leader of the Palestinians at the time. So that was the first year I went, as it is now, that was Mahmoud Abbas. And so he, you know, showed up at the Mass. I think during the Gloria, I think he processed in during the Gloria, sat up front. but it also made it, the security was very tight. So the major square is surrounded by people, policemen with machine guns, which is, you know, the more one travels overseas, the more one gets used to heavily armed police and armed forces being on the streets. This is not, it's not something we're used to in America. And so to go to church, to go to Mass on Christmas Eve with armed guards was a little different than I was used to. And this was, like I said, this was years ago, probably six years ago, I believe, when I first did this. And then, of course, then to have Mahmoud Abbas in Mass, and he doesn't stay for the whole Mass, so he gets up and leaves before communion, being that he's obviously not Christian and, you know, would not be welcome to receive. I won't make a snarky comment about American politicians, but so Mahmoud Abbas leaves before communion. So the Mass is rather disturbed in that way by the politics that surround it.
And presumably the local political leader and Abbas, like Yasser Arafat before him, is almost semi-deified culturally. When they come in or when they go out, they become the center of attention, and everybody, you know, turns to greet them or shake their hand or be acknowledged by them. And they presumably kind of become the focus of attention at that point.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, very distracting to me during the Mass. You know, so that's why I subsequently have not attended the Midnight Mass before. And that Mass during that time also, and subsequently, I, you know, when I go for Christmas now, I've, had the honor of being invited into, a family, of Christians who live in Bethlehem, invite me to their home for Christmas dinner. Which is lovely, and eat the, you know, they always want to know what I want and to eat, and I always say, well, I want to eat exactly what you would eat if I weren't there. And they make a beautiful meal with some chicken, grilled chicken, and these vegetables stuffed with rice. But it's just very traditional and very beautiful. And so to be with them and to be able to talk freely in their home about their struggles, because, of course, you know, out on the street, people won't all talk very freely to somebody that they don't know. But, you know,
is it difficult to be a Christian in Bethlehem these days?
Right. It's very tough to be a Christian in Bethlehem, you know, in part because of how they're treated by their Muslim neighbors. But also in part because of, you know, something that we don't understand as Americans, and one of the things that makes it personally a little difficult for me sometimes in Bethlehem is, you know, my father's family is Jewish, so I'm tribally Jewish. And what we don't understand in the Mideast is how important tribes are. So there are a lot of people in Bethlehem who believe that because they're of the same tribe as the Muslims in terms of being Palestinian, that their allegiance should lie with the tribe, even ahead of lying with their religious allegiance. So there have been political alliances that between the Palestinians and the Muslims, between the Palestinian Christians and the Muslims, that in some ways have made the Christians' lives much more difficult.
If I'm not mistaken, the current, correct me if I'm wrong, the current Latin patriarch was quoted as saying, I'm a Palestinian first and a Christian second.
I don't know, because the current Palestinian the current patriarch is not Palestinian, Jordanian. That comment was made by a politician in Bethlehem.
Okay, gotcha. I stand corrected.
Okay, and I don't know that I publicly want to go on record. But it's
well,
very
I will say something, because I was an eyewitness to this, which is that the previous Latin patriarch, Mikhail Sabbat, I actually read a Episcopal letter that he wrote to his flock calling for the Intifada, saying it can be a religious duty to take up arms against essentially the State of Israel.
Right. There is
and I was rather horrified by that. So clearly the nationalism intersects with the religious leadership at times.
Yeah. And so, for instance, I went to Midnight Mass one year at Bethlehem University, which is a Catholic university run by the British, and the homily, and I went because it was in English, and sometimes when you're away in pilgrimage and you're not with a group, it may become days without hearing Mass in English, and so I thought, well, I'll go to Mass in English. And the homily was basically a denouncement of Israel and a denouncement of any sort of solution to the political problems that didn't, it basically called for Israel to leave the Holy Land during the homily. So, you know, and this is in the university in Bethlehem. So this is what, you know, in the university in Bethlehem, the students, these are Christian students, and they're Muslim students also, but the students have to take a course in Islam and the history of Islam, and it's required, but it's not required to take one on the history of Catholicism, of Christianity. So, you know, there's very much the anti-Semitic feeling. I mean, one of the years that I was in Bethlehem, I was at the parade, and I saw these three people who, you know, I mean, maybe I can recognize them because of tribal whatever, but I mean, I looked at the three of them and I knew they were Jewish college students in Bethlehem, and I said, you know, how did y'all end up here? Because Israelis are forbidden to go to Bethlehem. So, because it's not safe, they can't be guaranteed their safety there. So the safety of a Jewish person in Bethlehem could not be guaranteed. So, you know, obviously when I go, I don't speak of my connection to Judaism or because there's so much anti-Semitism. Because there's a lack of understanding between Israel in the Bible and the historicity of the Jews and salvation history and the current Israeli government. That whole situation is very poorly understood by the Christians in Bethlehem. So, you know, the level of anti-Semitism is very, very palpable. So...
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good place to turn kind of a little bit back theologically and say that one of the reasons I wanted to do this show is because the only hope the world has is prayer wherever you turn. And certainly the only hope the world has with respect to the Middle East and the conflict in the Holy Land and the conflict between the Muslim nations and Christians in those Muslim nations and Jews in a nearby Jewish nation, all of that, the only fruitful place to turn is prayer and to beg God's mercy on the world and on all of his people. And this is the year of mercy, so if there's one message to come across from this, the, you know, sordid underbelly of what Christmas is like in Bethlehem, it's an exhortation, as it says in the psalm, to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, to pray for peace in the Holy Land, because there is no, there's certainly no political solution.
And, you know, from the first time I went to the Holy Land until even the most recent, and, you know, obviously the people that I know and I speak to in Bethlehem, they know the truth. They see the truth. And I think that there is a group of people, be them Muslim, Jewish, or Christian, who understand that the solution is only going to come in a supernatural way. And they see the truth, and they know that politics offers them no answer. And, you know, especially for those people who, you know, live in Bethlehem and live under the hardship of all of the institutions really not supporting what they know to be true. I think we need to pray, you know, with them and for them. So.
And of course, the Christians are, in a sense, they're in the worst situation of all, because in any Muslim majority environment, they're fairly rightless and discriminated against and actually even legally exploited. And yet, politically, they're, of course, aligned, they're Palestinians, and they're aligned with a population which is essentially a sworn enemy of the survival of Israel. So, of course, things are very tense between them and the Jewish Israelis also, and they're really kind of caught in the middle. I don't know if you know the statistics. I don't remember the statistics, but the Christian population of Bethlehem has plummeted in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yes, I don't know the exact numbers, but I believe it's down to Bethlehem is less than 3% Christian now. And, you know, I think there were times when it was, you know, over 50% and not that distant past.
And if I can go back to the beginning of the show, it started out 100% Jewish and it's 0% Jewish now.
Exactly. And of course also the tone of the relationship, you know, with their neighbors has changed dramatically over the years that I've been there. And
can you tell the story about the cul-de-sac behind the convent wall? The dead end street that backs
sure.
up against the
So when I first started going to the Carmelite Monastery, and that was in 2012, I believe, and I spent quite a bit of time there. I was able to spend about 6 weeks there one summer, as well as going at Christmas and some other times. There's a street that dead ends up against the steps that go down to Carmel, and you know, it's fenced in, but you can see through the fence and everything. And the first year I went, there are children who play on the cul-de-sac, and, you know, they play soccer and other street. There are children playing in the street. And, you know, they were, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old. They were young children. And the first year I went, when I walked down the steps, they clambered over to the fence and started speaking to me in English and asking me where I was from, and so proud that they could speak English and saying hello and these big friendly smiles on their face. And last year when I went, it's the same group of boys playing, and now instead of coming over and saying hi, they were throwing rocks and chunks of ice at all of us who are visiting Carmel. And it's a sad place to end. I hope not. I hope you'll pick us up out of that sad place. But,
sure.
You know, well, clearly over the years, they've learned to hate their Christian neighbors.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's time to end the show anyway, and it's always nice to end on the note of prayer. So let me just read Psalm 122, verse 6. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. And if there's one overarching theme of this show today, I think it should be that. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Pray for the peace of the Holy Land. It'll bring a great blessing on the Holy Land, and it'll bring a great blessing on the person who prays for it, because this is, in a way, it truly is the spiritual center of the world. It's the only earth on earth that the God-man walked on when he was in the flesh. So I guess with that, I should just thank our audience for listening. I want to thank you, Claire, for being on. Very much.
Thank you.
And I hope this has been interesting and edifying to our listeners. And I hope that you join us again next week on Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, on Radio Maria. Bye for now.